eyeing and could afford. It was a well-used silver Honda, but to her eyes, it was the most beautiful car in the world. Not because she cared about the car itself, but because it meant escape from the abuse. The day she picked up the car, she drove to the trailer park and packed up her things while her mother was sleeping off a party. There wasn't much she really cared about, and she didn't want Bosca to come home and catch her. So as soon as she had the basics together in a couple of black plastic bags, she left for the cabin. Before she left, she wrote a brief note, telling her mother that she was moving away and would not be back. Driving up to the cabin and seeing those two mountains, one to either side, felt like the warm embrace of her grandparents. She knew she was at last safe. The first thing she did when she got inside the cabin was to load the Walther P-22. If they figured out where she was and Bosca came to haul her back to the trailer, she intended to blow his brains out. Angela didn't worry about her mother coming to bring her home. She was a lot stronger than her mother, and besides, her mother was more likely to smoke some crack as her reaction to the situation than come get her. Drugs were her answer to everything. Once she put her things away in the bedroom, Angela sat down on the bed and cried with grief that her grandparents weren't there, and cried with joy that she had finally escaped the abuse at home. As it happened, there was no need to worry about Bosca. He was unexpectedly killed in a motorcycle accident. He ran a stop sign running from the police and was broadsided by a woman in a minivan. Karma was a bitch. 15. The next time one of those unexpected mental doorways opened was several years after she had moved to the cabin. She had made sure to keep her grades high enough that she was able to graduate high school. Being out of high school was a huge relief. Graduation was a joyful event because it meant formally leaving the misery of childhood behind. Angela had always thought of herself as an adult trapped in a child's body. At long last, her body and mind had reached parity. She was truly an adult, even if not legally until she was 21. Being done with school and on her own, she was finally able to work full-time. One of the houses she cleaned was for a couple who were both lawyers. Mr. and Mrs. Bollard appreciated the job Angela did at their house, so they asked her to clean their office as well. Since they were pleasant and treated her fairly, Angela was happy to do it. One day, as she was emptying waste baskets, she overheard Mr. Bollard telling his wife that he needed to get some papers across town. They were debating how they would do it, since it was urgent they get some signatures, but neither could leave the office right then. Angela straightened. "I'll do it." They both looked up at her.
"What?"
Mr. Bollard asked. "I'd be happy to do it." When they stared at her for a moment, she added, "I have a courier service." She lied. "I can deliver the papers for you." They shared a "why not" look with each other. Mrs. Bollard slid the papers into an envelope, wrote a name and address on it, and handed the manila envelope to Angela. "Ask him to sign the papers. When he's done, please bring them right back here." "No problem," Angela said. After that, they gradually came to depend on her to deliver things like court documents on a regular basis. One day, when she brought a package to them, Mr. and Mrs. Bollard asked her to sit down.
"You do know that you're charging half the going rate other courier services charge, don't you?"
Angela shrugged. "It's enough to cover my costs and make me some money. I appreciate the work and I'm satisfied with what I make doing it. It's an attractive enough price that you keep using me instead of anyone else. You're happy, I'm happy." Mr. Bollard leaned back in his leather chair and tapped a finger on the armrest as he studied her face.
"You're more than you appear."
Angela frowned. "Excuse me?" He shrugged.
"You look... well, you don't exactly look like the determined and meticulous young woman you really are."
Angela frowned. "Are you unhappy with something I do?"
No, he said. No, not at all. It's just that we've learned we can depend on you. You don't screw up. You get contracts and papers where they need to go, when they need to be there.
So what's the problem?
You don't have a business license, do you?
Well,
insurance.
I have insurance.
I don't mean on your car. I mean, do you have a business license and business insurance? Are you insured and bonded? Did you post a bond to have a courier service?
Angela let out a sigh. She didn't have any of that. She imagined that the money she made with her new courier service was about to evaporate. No, she admitted. He appraised her for a time, considering something.
You do a good job, Angela, taking care of our house and the office, as well as the other places you clean. And you always get documents where they need to go on time, and get them back to us on time. But you need to have a business license if you are going to do this kind of service for us. And you need to be bonded to have a courier service. We're lawyers. We can't use you without everything being legal.
Angela could feel herself sinking into her chair. I see.
I'll tell you what. My wife and I can handle all the legal matters. You'll need to have an official business name and the money for the bond, but we can take care of the paperwork and filings for you so that you don't get into legal trouble.
Angela sat up straighter. You would do that for me?
Sure, Mrs. Ballard said. You've helped us out of spots enough times.
What would the bond cost?
Mr. Ballard smiled. We'll make you a deal. We'll handle all that, and in return, you just deliver documents for us for 2 months for no charge. That should cover the costs. After you're legal, then we can not only use you, we can recommend your courier service to other lawyers and people we know.
That would be great. Thank you both.
With that deal, Angela moved up from maid service to courier service. Once she had a business name that played on the meaning of her name and her license, she bought herself a plastic magnetic sign for the door of her car. Angela's Messenger Service. Give your package wings. Some of the clients the Ballards dealt with were people in a variety of legal trouble. Some were criminals. The people in legal trouble started to ask her to deliver documents for them as well. Besides the lawyers she handled, she became known among people in legal trouble as a trustworthy courier service. They liked that she made a point of her service being confidential. She never asked questions, and she never talked about her other clients. She discovered that the more confidential she kept everything, the more business she got. Not only from people in legal trouble, but even from places like the hospital, where the law required patient privacy. It was the end of one hot summer day, during one of those deliveries, that the new mental doorway opened for her. Mrs. Ballard had given her a package of legal documents to deliver to a seedy little bar at the edge of town, called Barry's Place. The plain block building was rather dark inside. There were people at small tables, and a few at the bar. A rotating ball in the ceiling projected sparkling light over everything. When she spotted a man behind the bar, she crossed the room, weaving her way among the patrons. He watched her, out of the corner of an eye, as he dried glasses. She leaned in over the bar to be heard over the rock music.
I'm looking for Barry.
I'm Barry. I own the place. What can I do for you?
Angela handed him the envelope with legal papers. He looked at the return address of the law firm.
Ah, good. Thanks.
Angela turned to leave, but he told her to hold on. She turned back. He smiled, but not in a slimy way. Angela knew slimy smiles filled with meaning when she saw them. Barry's smile was pleasant and respectful.
I don't mean this in a sleazy way, he said, but you have some damn fine legs.
Angela was wearing low-rise shorts. She knew he had been looking at her legs when she walked across the room. Thanks, she said, cautiously, fearing a proposal.
Have you ever thought about tending bar?
That wasn't what she had been expecting. Angela made a bit of a face.
No. I don't know anything about being a bartender.
It's not all that hard.
He gestured around.
This isn't a fancy place. I can teach you all you need to know. Besides, you have the most important part down pat already.
She frowned. The most important part? He gestured with the hand holding the rag.
Those legs of yours. I mean, damn. Legs like that bring in business, and they could earn you more in tips than you could ever make delivering packages.
Really?
How old are you?
20. Barry sighed.
Crap. You need to be 21. How long until your legal age?
5 months. He made a face as he considered the obstacle.
You come back here on your birthday, and I can give you some part-time work. If it doesn't make you at least double what you make with your courier service, I'll make up the difference, but I guarantee you, it's not going to cost me a dime.
Angela thought about it briefly. She would certainly like to make more money. If she worked at the bar at night, she could get a better car and still have her courier service. She didn't want to give that up.
My name is Angela. I'll see you on my birthday.
Barry flipped the towel back to lay it across his shoulder.
Cut those shorts shorter when you come back, Angela, and you'll make triple what you make now.
Angela smiled. She always thought her legs were too long. If they could make her more money without having to wrap them around some scumbag, she thought that she might as well do it.
Deal. I'll be back just as soon as I'm 21.
See you then.
Barry smiled, but in a friendly, non-threatening way, before picking up a few empty boxes and heading into the back room. When Angela turned around, she met the gaze of a man sitting close by at the bar. He was a bull of a man, at least 6'4" and 250 pounds. His sandy blonde hair had been pulled back in a ponytail. His hairline was just starting to recede, the way it sometimes did prematurely with men in their late 20s. He had on a sleeveless denim jacket that showed off not only his tangle of tattoos that colored both arms, but his muscles. All the tattoos were grim. There were skulls, snakes, reptilian monsters, and graves with ravens overhead. A snake tattoo coiled up from beneath his denim jacket to bare its fangs on the side of his neck. He had a diamond, or maybe a fake diamond, in each earlobe. Although, just his presence told her they had to be real. He was the kind of man who would not appreciate having it pointed out that he was wearing fake diamonds. For the first time in her life, and with absolute certainty, she realized that she was staring into the eyes of a killer. In that instant, she was sucked through that doorway, and her life changed irrevocably. Besides comprehension, fear also flashed through every fiber of her being. She was frozen in place. Sweat felt like ice on her skin. In that instant, gazing into the man's eyes, she had a vision. It was something that had never happened to her before. She saw this man straddling a girl with short red hair. They were in one of the old abandoned factories with broken windows. Angela knew that place. It was just getting dark in that vision. He pulled off the girl's jeans and panties so she was naked from the waist down. She was begging him not to hurt her. She promised not to tell anyone if he would let her go. She trembled in terror. Angela knew the feeling well. In her mind, she could see how excited he was becoming by her begging. It thrilled him. He got off on her fear. He ripped open her blouse. She screamed and begged. He suddenly stabbed her in each breast. It was a quick 1-2 jab. It wasn't deep enough to mortally wound her. He didn't want her to die yet. He wanted to terrify her. Her screams excited him even more than her begging. He started stabbing her, making her scream all the louder. He held the knife in both hands, lifting it over his head and then driving it down over and over as fast as he could. He continued stabbing her in a frenzied fury even after she had gone still. As she was gurgling her last few breaths, eyes wide open, he undid his pants and penetrated her. He didn't orgasm until she was long dead. He liked that. It gave him a sense of triumph to fuck her into death. When he finally pulled out of her, he went wild, slashing her face repeatedly until it was unrecognizable. He found a nearby piece of iron and used it to bash out her teeth. When he was done, he wrapped her in a piece of burlap that had been lying in a pile of rubble in a corner. He then carried her outside to an old cistern with a concrete lid. He was muscular and had no trouble lifting it aside. He threw the girl with red hair down into the lonely darkness and then replaced the lid. He doubted that anyone would ever find her before she rotted away to nothing. But if they did, with her skull crushed and without her teeth, he figured they would have a hard time of identifying her. He would later throw the pieces of teeth into the woods.
"Well, well,"
the man sitting there at the bar said, the man whose visions she'd just had.
"Aren't you just the prettiest little thing?"
Angela stood paralyzed by what she had just seen in her mind's eye, what she had seen this man do to an innocent girl with red hair. The whole thing had all come to her in a millisecond. It was as if she were recalling a vivid memory. His memory. She could even feel the shiver of his sexual gratification as he'd come in the freshly dead corpse. She didn't know how she knew the whole thing was true, but she knew it just as surely as if she had been there when he had done it.
"What's the matter?" he asked. "Pussy got your tongue?"
"Fuck off," she said to the guy, her gaze still locked on his. She knew saying that would bait the guy. She wanted, more than anything, to bait him. "Asshole," she added for good measure. Angela had no idea how she could have recognized a killer for what he was. She didn't have any idea how she could have had visions of him murdering the girl with short red hair. Angela knew, in that moment, that there was no going back through that doorway. Not ever. She knew that her life would never be the same. The only explanation that made any sense to her was that she truly was a freak of nature. Her mother's constant drug use, along with that of the tweaker who had fathered her, had left Angela to grow and develop in a toxic broth of what was flowing around in her mother's veins. Angela had been born broken. The only thing she knew for sure was that she had, for the first time ever in her life, come eye to eye with a killer. It terrified her. But more than that, it excited her. 16. For the next few days, Angela couldn't get the guy out of her head. She couldn't keep the horrifying details of what he had done out of her nightmares. She knew, with every fiber of her being, that it was true. She did her best to put him out of her mind as she went about delivering and picking up packages. All the while, she kept thinking about how much more money she could make tending bar. There weren't many good-paying jobs in Milford Falls. She decided that she would get some books on bartending so she would be prepared when she turned 21. But in the background, there was always the memory of the man in the bar and the haunting images she had seen in his eyes. As Angela went about her deliveries, she searched the people she saw, looking for him. She didn't know how she knew it, but she knew for certain that she had not seen the last of him. That thought made her queasy with fear. At the same time, it excited her in a way that nothing had ever excited her before. She dreaded the thought of ever seeing that monster again, and yet she felt intoxicated with the thought of encountering him. She finally decided that she was going to make herself crazy thinking about him, so she did her best to put him from her mind. She thought instead about the bartending job Barry had offered her. None of the people there were anywhere near as scary as the people who had hung around her mother's trailer, so she was sure she could do it. When she finished all her deliveries for the day, she stopped at a bookstore and picked up 2 books on bartending. She deliberately selected the simpler books, with basic drinks and lessons on the trade, rather than how to make fancier drinks. Barry's bar was decidedly not fancy. On the highway, before reaching the road that turned off to the north and eventually went past her cabin, she saw a blue muscle car parked off the side of the road. She remembered seeing a car like that in the parking lot of the bar. Angela did not believe in coincidences. It would be a long walk to her place from where the car was parked, but on the other hand, the distance served to diminish suspicion. When she reached the drive up to her cabin, she scanned the bushes and trees beyond the meadow as she lowered the cable. When she put the cable back up after entering, she looked around but didn't see any footprints in the dirt. Of course, someone could have walked in from a different direction to avoid leaving footprints. When she parked and then went into the dark cabin, she knew he was in there, somewhere. She could feel him. Her gaze searched every dark corner, but she saw no sign. Heart hammering, she unlocked the basement door, then returned to the living room and turned on a single light. After turning on the light in the living room, she deliberately calmed her thoughts. Once she set aside the mental distractions, she began to feel his presence radiating from her bedroom. She found that as she focused on him, she could feel him crouching there in the bedroom, waiting for her. She did not intend to play into his plan of walking into her bedroom so he could jump her. Instead, she flopped down in the chair at the dark end of the living room. She yawned and made some noise, pulling the footstool closer and plunking her feet down on it. Then she waited. He was waiting, too. For nearly an hour, he waited, until his lust for her got the better of him. She could feel his hatred of her raw femininity, and the way it taunted him. She could feel his rage building to the point where he had to do something about it. He stepped quietly into the living room. It wasn't a big house. The hall from the bedroom entered right into the center of the living room, so he wasn't far away from her. In his mind, he measured the few strides and big lunge it would take for him to be on her. Because of the isolation of her cabin and with him being so much bigger than her, he felt safe and in complete control. He knew he had her where he wanted her. His mind was already filled with visions of the things he intended to do to her. Those thoughts petrified her. When he took another step into the living room, he saw her arm resting on her leg. He froze when he saw the gun in her hand that she had leveled at him. When he took a closer look and saw that it was a .22, he grinned and put his hands half up in fake surrender.
"Whoa there, pretty lady. You aren't going to blast away at me with that little pea shooter, are you?"
His grin reflected the sinister thoughts filling his head, but revealed absolutely no fear. "Could be," she said. "We'll have to see how it goes." He lowered his hands.
"I don't think a pretty little thing like you would have the nerve to shoot someone, especially someone who only means to get to know you a little better."
She calmly stared, gun still pointing at him.
"Besides, even if you did have the nerve to shoot at me," he said as he gestured at her gun, "and even if you could manage to hit me, that little thing wouldn't do me much harm before I got over there and took it away from you."
"It would do enough harm if I shot you between the eyes." Her gun barrel followed every slight movement he made. He glared for a moment before his grin returned.
"I don't think you're that good of a shot, especially in the dark.
How about I take that thing away from you and shove it up your pretty little ass?
How about I shoot those diamonds out of your earlobes just to show you how good a shot I am? She cocked her head. You know, most guys with an earring only wear one. He reflexively touched one of his ears before letting his hand drop.
Yeah. Well, I'm twice what most guys are.
His expression turned murderous. He suddenly started to take a lunging stride toward her. Angela had the gun up in both hands and pulled off two shots before he'd finished the stride. She could see the splash of blood as his earlobes, along with their diamonds, were blown off. He lurched to a stop as he put his hands to each ear.
God damn it! He screamed. You motherfucking little cunt!
His right foot started forward. Angela fired before his left foot could leave the ground. The round blew apart his left kneecap like a clay pigeon. He crumpled to the ground, clamping both hands over his knee as he screamed and rolled and cursed. Angela, still sitting in the chair, her feet propped up on the footrest, hadn't moved yet, except to fire her gun those three times.
You goddamn little bitch! I'm going to break your arms off and stuff them up your fucking cunt!
He managed to pull himself up, hopping on his good leg to get his balance. He yanked a knife from a sheath at his belt under his vest. When he lifted it over his head, Angela put a round through the joint in his wrist, shattering the bones. The round left a splatter of blood as it went through the wall behind him. The knife clattered across the floor.
Fuck! He screamed. What the fuck's wrong with you? You got no fucking right to do this!
Angela didn't answer. She got up and walked around him toward the hallway between the kitchen and bedroom. He was cradling his injured wrist. On her way past, without a word, she fired a round into his other knee, shattering the patella. He fell over on his side, clamping his good hand over the freshly wounded knee. Angela opened the basement door. She gestured with her gun. This way. Move.
Move? Are you fucking crazy? I can't stand up!
I didn't tell you to stand up. I told you to move. You've still got a good hand. Use it to drag yourself in here. She saw him look toward the knife on the floor. She walked around him, just out of reach of his good hand, her gun pointed at his face the whole time, and picked up his knife. I think by now you ought to know that I don't miss. Now drag your sorry ass over to that doorway. I'm not going to tell you again. Panting, as the pain was beginning to bear down on him in earnest, he finally did as she ordered and propped himself up on one elbow and his good hand to drag himself across the wooden floor. He grunted with each pull, leaving a smeared blood trail behind. He reminded her of a wounded seal. He stopped, propped up on his one good arm, halfway into the dark doorway. Keep going, she said. He looked back over his shoulder.
I can't see. It's pitch black. How the fuck do you expect?
Angela slammed her boot solidly into his back between his shoulder blades. It was enough to topple him in and down the stairway. She could hear him thudding and thumping as he tumbled down the steep steps. When he finally smacked onto the floor at the bottom and came to a stop, he let out a groan. Angela flipped on the lights and saw him crumpled at the bottom of the steps, only partially conscious. Without wasting a moment, while he was dazed and out of it, she raced down the steps, and before he regained his senses, pulled a law enforcement-grade zip-tie restraint from a box of them she had on a shelf. She twisted one arm behind his back and pressed her knee on it to hold him down, while she collected his other arm and twisted it back behind him. She used the zip-tie cuffs to secure his wrists. He howled in pain when she grabbed his bleeding wrist and yanked the plastic strap tight. For good measure, she put another pair of the zip-tie cuffs on his ankles. With his blown-out knees, she didn't think he would be able to do anything, even without the handcuffs. And she could always put a bullet in his brain if things got out of hand. But she wanted to make sure he was immobile for what she had planned. She also wanted him to feel completely helpless. the way the red-haired girl had felt. It was frightening to be in the presence of such a brutal killer, but at the same time, she felt more alive than any time since she had been with her grandparents. Angela rolled him over and waited patiently until he regained consciousness. Once he did, he turned his head, looking around. He twisted and flopped around trying to get free, looking like a fish out of water. He was strong, but not strong enough, especially with his injuries.
"God damn you!" he screamed at her.
"Why the fuck are you doing this?"
Angela lifted an eyebrow at him. "You broke into my house and hid in my bedroom waiting to jump me while all kinds of nasty thoughts danced through your head. And you ask why I'm doing this?"
"I didn't mean anything by it. I wasn't going to hurt you."
"Yeah, right."
"You can't just shoot someone like this. It's illegal. I'm going to call the police on you. I'm going to sue your fucking ass for everything you've got."
Ignoring his threats, Angela went to one knee beside him, the wrist of her gun hand resting over her other knee. "I'm bursting with questions," she said. "I'd like you to give me answers."
"Fuck you!"
he yelled. He was so angry he was drooling spittle.
"I'm not telling you a fucking thing!"
"Really?" Angela got up and went to a shelf, where she retrieved a handheld propane blowtorch and a flint igniter that had belonged to her grandfather. She opened the valve on the propane tank, put the steel cup of the igniter up by the tip of the blowtorch, and squeezed the spring steel handles to strike the flint. After the blowtorch lit, she adjusted the flame and then carried it over to her houseguest. Angela again went to one knee beside him and plunked the blowtorch down beside him where he could see it. "Like I said, I'm just full of questions." He screamed and flopped, trying to get away.
"Fuck you! I'm not telling you anything!"
Angela picked up the torch. "Oh, I think you are."
"If you know what's good for you, you'll let me go!"
"Tell me about the girl with red hair." He froze, his panicked eyes turning up at her.
"What?"
"The girl with red hair. I want you to tell me everything you did to her."
"I don't know any girl with red hair."
Angela swiped the flame across his face. His flesh blackened. He screamed and shook his head to get it away from the torch, so she put the tip of the flame to his upper arm. The fat beneath the flesh bubbled and the skin crackled. The whole room smelled like cooking meat. He panted and squealed. It was exhilarating. "Every detail," she repeated as she held the flame up before his eyes. His gaze went between the hissing flame and her eyes.
"I didn't mean anything by it. It was an accident. It was just rough sex, that's all."
Angela shoved the tip of the flame toward his left eye. It burned his eyelashes off. He howled with a blood-curdling scream as he jerked his head violently from side to side. She planted a boot on his jaw to keep his face still. In order to find out if her vision was accurate, if it had really happened the way she saw it, she needed him to tell her the details of what he had done. She knew without doubt that he was a killer, and yet she still had a hard time believing that she could actually have visions of such things. She had to know for sure if he really did everything to the red-haired girl that she saw in that vision, or if she had only imagined it. With her boot on his jaw, and using all her weight to hold his head still, she burned out his left eye. She took her boot away and let him scream and flop for a while. As he shook in pain, Angela leaned in closer. "Every detail. Start at the beginning." He looked again at the flame with his good eye. His jaw trembled uncontrollably. She saw him not as a man, but as what he really was, a monster who murdered women. He might as well have been a rabid dog that needed to be put down. What he once might have been, he no longer was. He was now a killer who would kill again, given the chance. In fact, he had intended to murder her this night and have sex with her corpse.
I took her to an abandoned building. I told you. We had rough sex, that's all.
Angela lifted the torch. The next time you lie to me, I'm going to burn out your other eye, and that will only be the beginning. I want every detail, beginning to end. The time has come for a full confession. Don't leave out anything. She thumped the propane torch on the floor to make her point. Start talking. With the blowtorch sitting close, he finally abandoned all resistance and began spilling out everything he had done. He almost seemed relieved to confess his sins. Every detail matched exactly the vision she'd had that first instant she saw him in the bar and knew that he was a killer. It felt somehow amazing, but at the same time it sickened her to be in the mind of a killer, to see what he saw, what he had done, to be there and witness the terrifying, lonely helplessness of his victim. Angela was now that young red-haired girl's only advocate. It had been his first kill. It had been an orgy of rage that unlocked all his pent-up hatred and urges. It was his initiation to becoming a killer. Angela had put an end to it. She still wasn't sure how she was able to do such a thing, but that melted away into insignificance once she had confirmed that she had gotten every detail right. All that mattered now was that she could do it. That night, something snapped in her, the same way it had snapped when that bigger girl had punched her. She had passed through that mental doorway to become something she had never been before. She felt a new purpose in life. She had a new reason to live. There were killers, and then there was her. She was chaos among them. She was a disruptor. She was the unexpected, the unanticipated, the fly in their ointment. She was imbalance in their perfect equation of evil. Angela had found purpose. She spent the next 3 days down in the basement with the killer. He spent the next 3 days in hell on earth. She had wanted it to never end. 17. Raphael stood watching through the window in the small office as the team out on the dock loaded the metal cylinders into containment chests. It was exciting that after all the decades of planning and hard work, the mission was finally getting underway. He glanced to the clock and saw that they were behind schedule. There were long overland drives ahead of them, and then a journey aboard a freighter that would make several stops before reaching South America. Many other members of their team were already on their way. They would infiltrate in separate groups. He and his team had been training for this mission nearly their entire lives. It seemed surreal that the real thing was finally happening. He looked up and saw a cylinder slip from Jose's arms when he turned to tell a joke to some of the other men. The cylinder bounced twice and then rolled across the floor of the loading dock. Jose ran after it, tripping over his own feet along the way. When he stumbled, his foot hit the cylinder and sent it racing away even faster. Fortunately, Ronaldo planted his boot on the cylinder to stop it as it rolled past. Those cylinders were quite strong, but if they were mishandled, who knew what might happen? Jose, laughing, thanked Ronaldo, and then hoisted the cylinder up onto his shoulder as if it weren't the least bit dangerous, to carry it back to the crate.
Idiota,
Raphael muttered under his breath. Raphael couldn't hear through the window what Jose said to the other men when he brought the canister back, but some of them returned a weak laugh. Others shook their heads. Jose was the joker of the group. But this was hardly the time or place. Alejandro, Raphael's second in command, glanced up and gave Raphael a look as if to say he'd about had it with Jose. Raphael's jaw clenched tight. Like Alejandro and many of the others, he was sick and tired of Jose's antics. This was the mission of their lives, the mission they had trained for since early childhood. Now that the most critical parts of the plan were finally in motion, he didn't know how they could any longer afford to have such a fool involved in the operation. He wished they had cut Jose from the team years ago, but even then it would have been far too late to bring anyone else in. Even if there was no one to replace Jose, Jose was far more of a liability than an asset. Jose put everything at risk. Rafael turned when he heard the door. Hassan stormed into the room. His face was red. His thobe swirled around his legs when he came to a halt. He raised his shoulders and then lowered them to make slack to pull his bisht together in front. The rich brown cloak, edged in gold, was distinguished-looking, as it should be for someone of Hassan's importance.
¿Qué te trae aquí hoy?
Rafael asked. Hassan waved a hand.
Farsi, please. You know I don't speak Spanish.
Sorry, I forget. I asked what brings you here today.
I wanted to let you know that everything should be ready for final assembly by the time you get there.
Rafael folded his arms.
How are you getting the exploding bridge wire there so the team on site can continue the build without any delays?
The exploding bridge wire was of concern to Rafael because it was a vital component that had to be sent on ahead of them, and if it was intercepted or lost, it would jeopardize the entire mission. Like many of the critical parts, exploding bridge wire was usually illegal to possess in America and closely tracked.
Couriers, Hassan said. We have MOIS intelligence officers in foreign missions and embassies in most of the countries we need to send it through. They're waiting to hand off the package with the EBW from one of our trusted agents to another.
That makes sense, Rafael said. But what about in America? That is the most dangerous link in that chain. Do you have trusted agents who can make the final delivery?
We can't risk using any of our agents to deliver the package because it's possible they are known to American intelligence and under surveillance. The Americans have electronic communication techniques we don't always know about. Using our people for this delivery would risk everything. This is the operation that will make history. We can't afford to let it be compromised. To eliminate suspicion, we won't use our people or even sympathizers. We will instead use small, commercial couriers. They will hand the package in a chain from one to another. None of them know the contents or the destination. Each courier has only sequential instructions to deliver the package to another courier. In this way, only the final courier will open the instructions with the final destination. Your team there, run by Miguel.
But that final courier knows where the package is going, Rafael said. He has to deliver it there. That knowledge is a threat to us.
Hassan smiled.
You and I think alike, Rafael. That is why I had instructions placed in the box along with the EBW. The instructions order them to kill the courier and make the body vanish. No one will know what happened to that last courier, so there will be no connection to our team. In that way, the link is broken.
I used your name on the orders. Those are your men, so they will not hesitate to carry out the instructions.
Rafael nodded as he sighed with relief.
Good. What about you? You are behind schedule.
We have the most dangerous part done, and we will soon have the rest of the components loaded. All that is left is to load the power unit. We are close to having the shipment on its way. I have calculated that if we push, we can be back on schedule by the time we reach Brazil. Our people are keeping a watchful eye over the route until we arrive at each transfer point.
Hassan nodded. Rafael thought he looked distracted.
Is there some problem?
Hassan swiped a hand across his mouth and then smoothed down his black beard.
You remember me telling you that we sent Wahib into Jerusalem?
Raphael cast about in his memory for a moment.
Wahib, the assassin? Is that who you mean?
Hassan nodded.
He was recognized.
Raphael leaned in with a frown.
Recognized? How could he be recognized? As far as anyone knows, the enemy did not know of him. That is why he is so valuable. He was unknown to them, invisible, a ghost among the infidels.
Hassan glanced about as if the walls might have ears.
You recall me mentioning my suspicion.
Raphael tapped his thumb on his leg as he thought a moment.
You mean that the Mossad have people who can tell if someone they see has killed before?
Hassan nodded again.
From our intelligence reports, it sounds like that may have been what happened. Our people say that they saw two men together. One of them must have made a sign of some kind when Wahib turned his face in the man's direction. Because soldiers and men in plain clothes immediately swooped in out of nowhere and seized him.
Raphael found it a troubling notion.
You are certain of this? I mean, certain that he was recognized as having killed the enemy before? Simply by this man looking at his face? Not his face. His eyes.
Raphael's expression twisted.
It's hard to believe that such a thing is actually possible. I believe it is.
Hassan gave him a troubled look.
Wahib was a valuable man. No one there ever knew who he was. We are certain of that much. Where did you come up with this idea about people who can recognize in someone's eyes that they have killed before?
Hassan smoothed his beard again.
Wahib told me that when he was once on his way to an assignment, he encountered an old woman, one of our women, carrying home a jug of cooking oil so she could prepare a nightly meal for her family. As Wahib was making his way down the crowded alleyway, when she looked up into his eyes, she gasped.
Hassan held up a finger to make the point.
The old woman recognized he was a killer. He said that this had happened to him once before, and that he, in turn, was able to recognize in her eyes that she was one of those very rare people who just by his eyes knew that he had killed before. He said that both he and the old woman possessed a rare ability, each the counterpart of the other, and that was how she recognized him as a killer.
Raphael was dubious.
Just by looking at him?
By looking into his eyes, Hassan corrected, holding up the finger again to make his point.
Fortunately, he was able to calm her and assure her that he only killed Jews. She was very relieved and happy to hear this and went on her way, wishing him success and many more kills. Wahib said, though, that he had heard talk that the Mossad used people like this, people who were able to recognize killers. He believed that it was an ability like this old woman had. I am worried that there may be truth to what Wahib said.
Raphael lifted an eyebrow.
So, then you think that one of these people recognized him in this way and that was how he was captured?
Hassan let out a heavy sigh.
I believe so.
He adjusted his robe again.
Because of how serious this situation is, it is a high priority that this person working with the Mossad be eliminated. There is no telling what harm he could do to us, or what plans this enemy snake could ruin.
He gestured out the window to the dock.
Who knows? Even plans such as this. We cannot afford the risk. We need to eliminate this person. How in the world could we find this Jew with such vision?
Hassan regarded him with a sideways look.
That's the problem. You or I would not recognize a person with such special ability. It takes a very high-level killer to recognize them. A killer like Wahib. In order for them to tip their hand, it needs to be someone this Jewish devil would recognize as a killer. An ordinary assassin might not be aware they had been identified for what they are. We need a man who can recognize in their eyes that they can identify killers. That means we need someone like Wahib, but unfortunately he is now in the hands of the enemy. So, it would have to be someone who has killed before, but also a high-level killer, a special man, who could recognize this ability in the eyes of the enemy.
That is it exactly.
Allah willing, how in the world are you ever going to be able to find a man like that?
Hassan met Raphael's gaze.
We have a man.
Kasiel.
That I believe to have this ability to identify such an enemy.
What makes you think so?
This man, Kasiel, is a wolf in a thobe. He is a ruthless killer. Highly intelligent, clever, cunning. He speaks 5 languages fluently and several more well enough.
He is one of our men?
No. He is a murderer captured by the SSF.
Why would the state security forces be involved with a murder case? They usually only handle internal security.
They became involved because this was a special case, and in a way it did involve internal security. This man was preying on women, mostly, but also some men, slaughtering them for no reason or pattern we could understand. One of his most recent targets was an imam and his relatives. He killed the relatives as he worked toward the imam.
And the imam?
Hassan pulled a finger across his throat.
The Ministry of Intelligence and Security isn't sure where he was born, but they learned that for many years he has moved about from country to country. We know he has killed people from Italy to Tajikistan. I'm sure there are more victims. For some reason, he sometimes slaughters entire families. He is an international serial killer.
Hassan tilted his head closer.
I believe the seeming random nature of his victims means that they must have something in common. I suspect he was hunting those rare people who could recognize a killer, recognize him as a killer.
He was eliminating possible threats to himself?
In a way.
Hassan arched an eyebrow.
No wolf likes the sheepdog watching him hunt. I think that this man, Kasiel, was hunting sheepdogs.
That's a disturbing thought.
Anyway, he was to be executed shortly after he was captured. I went to him and made him an offer. I told him that we would release him on the condition that he worked exclusively for us, killed for us, going after people we selected, rather than going after victims of his choosing. We told him that he could kill them in any way he wished, as long as he killed them. The man is an animal, though. He is dangerous. I told him that if he killed any but the enemy we selected, we have agents everywhere. Eyes everywhere, and we would put him down as we would any rabid dog. He liked the idea of not being put to death, and even more the idea that we would let him continue to kill, even if it is those on our target list. So he agreed to the terms. I believe he has the ability to spot that person we are looking for, the man who recognized Wahib as an assassin.
So then you will send him after the Jewish snake who identified Wahib?
Yes. But it is not that easy, Hassan said. From what our informants tell us, the Israelis always have this special man under heavy guard. With the Mossad handling him, it will not be easy to get close to him, but he must be eliminated. He puts too much at risk.
He gestured out the window again.
Even this
How do you intend to do it, then?
Raphael was beginning to wonder why Hassan was bringing him into his confidence about the whole affair. After all, it was not Raphael's area of responsibility, and besides, he had critically important work ahead of him with his own team. They soon needed to be leaving on their mission. Hassan clasped his hands in front as he rocked back on his heels for a moment.
For Cassiel to get close to the target and eliminate it, we will need to use a distraction.
What sort of distraction?
A martyr. Someone who wants to serve Allah by carrying a bomb that will kill as many Jews as possible. We need someone who wants to be a martyr and bring honor to themselves. Someone who has never killed anyone yet, so they can't be recognized in the same way Wahib was recognized. That bomb will be the distraction Cassiel will need.
Raphael suddenly looked out the window to the people loading canisters. Jose was making stupid faces for the other men to see as he was screwing on the inner lid. He wasn't watching what he was doing and cross-threaded it. Once he saw what he'd done, he cursed at the lid as if it were to blame.
I think I have just the man for such an important mission.
Hassan saw where Raphael was looking.
Those are incredibly valuable men, Hassan said. We have trained all of you since you were babies just for this mission. We have much invested in all of you, and much hope lies with all of you.
It didn't sound like Hassan was objecting so much as he was testing the strength of Raphael's suggestion.
It is because we have so much invested in this plan that I believe this one must be culled. He makes too many mistakes. Our leaders, of course, had no way of knowing when we were still young children, but he isn't very intelligent. I fear that because he is so clumsy and ignorant, he could accidentally put the entire effort in jeopardy, without even intending to. As valuable as each of those men are, I think it would be better to select this one as the martyr you need. It would solve two problems at once.
Staring out the window, Hassan considered Raphael's suggestion. At last, he smiled.
Bring him in, and I will let him know that, because we have so much faith in him, he has been selected for a very special honor. He is to become a martyr far earlier than he had anticipated.
Raphael finally smiled himself.
He will be in awe that you have personally selected him for this mission.
18. After she finished cleaning the truck of Owen's blood and fingerprints, Angela went inside the cabin and unlocked the door to the basement. Her grandparents had always kept the door locked. Angela did as well. She flicked on the light and then descended the steep wooden stairs. The basement had a low ceiling and was only about half the length of the house. Granite ledges, sloping down from both ends, formed a shallow V under the house. The floor of the house spanned that V, resting on the rock ledge at either end. The teak floorboards of the basement were spaced about a quarter inch apart so that the floor could be washed down with the hose stored on the wall at one end. Water would run through the spaces and down the sloping stone underneath, and then into the chasm under the far side of the basement. That chasm was carefully concealed with a good-sized hatch. Her grandfather called that chasm the hellhole. She suspected that it had been created by a split in the gigantic granite formations of the mountains to either side, as if the mountains had pulled apart and the ground had cracked open, leaving a fissure that went down into the bowels of the earth. Her grandfather had put the geological oddity to use. Angela suspected he had chosen to build the cabin on that particular spot specifically because of that rift in the earth. After clearing away the trees, accumulated deadfall, and brush that had originally covered and concealed the opening, He built his place, resting right over that abyss. Angela liked to think of the two mountains, one to each side, as her grandparents watching over her.